Well, good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society, where everyone is welcome, always, no matter where you are on your religious, spiritual, sacred journey, whichever adjective you want to use. You are welcome no matter your sexual orientation, your ethnicity, where, as I said, where you are in the religious journey. You are welcome here. I always ask or encourage people to come more than once if this is one of their first times here, because our services vary from week to week. Sometimes I do the service. I am the minister here, Sandy Ingham. Sometimes people from within the congregation do it, which is happening today. And sometimes we have people from outside our congregation who do the service. Opening words then are these, and they're in your order of service if you want to follow along. The ethic of reverence for life recognizes no such thing as a relative ethic. The maintenance and enhancement of life are the only things it counts as being good in themselves. All destruction of and injury to life, from whatever circumstances they may result, are reckoned by it as evil. I look forward to Matt expounding on that in a few minutes. I have a note that the Creed Hatch family will light the chalice. Perhaps it will just be a portion of the Creed. Do you want to light it and I'll say the words, or do you want
to say the words?
Okay, this happens. Liam must have had a moment.
Yes.
Thank you. Our loving, free faith has a part to play, a vision to uphold, and a call that sounds from sea to sea to sea. If you are here this morning, you are called to the ministry of all to all, to make heaven here on earth, now, in this place, on this planet, for all people. And thank you, and Liam's back, and we'll give you another chance. Now it's Matt's turn. Matt Tedesco is a member of our fellowship and a professor of philosophy at Beloit College. And I asked him before the service what he wanted me to say, and he said he'd fill you in on all the essentials, because I'm sorry, I forgot to read his very lengthy and very impressive biography. And those of you who were here, boy, when was that, Matt? January?
January 12th.
January, oh, birthday. January 12th, yes. Know that, he does, he did one time, a wonderful job and talking about life and the beginning of life that time and so much more. And there was so much food for thought in that one. I'm still mulling that over. And someday I'd like to do a service with you. I mean, not this way, but where we both speak. Take it away.
All right, let's see, we're going to hook up. I was told by Dirk this is called the diva mic because of the way it's set up. So if I inadvertently break into, My Heart Will Go On at any point, you'll know it's the mic taking over. While Dirk's helpfully setting up the screen, I'll just sort of reiterate what Sandy just said. So I teach philosophy at Beloit College. One of the courses that I teach with some regularity is environmental ethics. And so I guess after the last talk, Penny approached me and said, well, you know, what if you give something else to the community close to Earth Day? And I thought, okay, I could do that. So at any rate, that's why I'm here today. And so what I want to do today, just as a kind of overview, really similar to last time, I don't mean to in the next few minutes stake out any positions or defend any theses. Really all I want to do is hopefully raise some provocative questions to think about and talk about for the next little while. So that's really what I'm aiming for. So hit the next slide. So a little bit about the backdrop. So like I said, the impetus for Penny inviting me to come today is that Earth Day was just a few days ago on Tuesday. Happy confluence of events. I didn't know it was Save the Frogs Day also. But we've got a variety of environmentally oriented days having just passed us this week. That's sort of one element of the backdrop. I think also timing-wise, I mentioned a couple of both global and local developments there up on the slide. Just a few weeks ago, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released yet another of their reports. You might have heard about it in the news. They got pretty widespread coverage. The news, it's not very good, right? I mean, in a nutshell, the report basically said, it's not too late if we act aggressively and immediately. I don't think immediate or aggressive action is forthcoming. So anyway, a somewhat grim report in the last few weeks. And I also, sort of as I was thinking about this talk today, I was thinking about a talk that we had several months ago on the proposed taconite mine up in the Northwest, and I thought that might be a kind of a meaningful orientation point for some of the things I wanted to talk about today. And so I thought I'd refer to that along the way. And then the other thing, and this sort of connected with the title of this little talk, I wanted to mention it briefly here. The other kind of orienting point for today's talk is this seventh principle of Unitarian Universalism. I'll just say this. I love principles. I think it's not surprising, right? Because you're spending so much time doing philosophy. But I think principles are just so fascinating, sort of teasing out what they mean and what they entail. I'll sort of say, I remember one of the first, so my family and I have been coming here almost a year now. I remember one of the first times we came here, and I was just trying to get a sense of, what Unitarian Universalism is about. And I was reading the principles kind of, up on the wall around here. And I remember what was sort of striking me back then, right? Which is, first off, they're not exactly symmetrical, right? If you sort of look at the way they're structured, right? So, most of them start, we believe. They're all normative in a sense, right? They all are connected with how we ought to live or what we ought to do, but the connection is more or less direct depending on how the principle is framed, right? So, for example, some of them say, we believe in something. So for example, we believe in justice, or we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And as I said, that can be normative, but it can also be a little bit passive, right? You can believe in something and really not do anything about it, right? Similarly, I was thinking, so this one's a little more direct, right? We believe in encouraging, so it's connected with a verb, okay. So that's a little bit more active. And then as I was sort of reading them, you come to, so there's the seventh one's in the corner over there. We respect, it's the only one that doesn't start, at least in the way it's framed on the walls here, it's the only one that doesn't start, we believe. Right, it's that we respect the interdependent web of which we are all a part. So I remember one of those first days thinking that's really interesting, because in some ways that's the most directly connected with action of all of the principles. So I remember back then thinking, that's such an interesting principle. At any rate, I thought that would be also an interesting orienting point for today's talk, to think a little bit about what that might mean to respect this interdependent web. Could you hit the next slide, Ken? Thanks. So like I said, I thought that taconite mine would make for an interesting way to orient this talk, mostly because, given that we've heard about it in previous talks, at least some of us have, my guess is many of you in the room know more about it than I do, and so it might be a little bit familiar as a kind of orienting point. And so what I've sort of got up here are just quotes that I just pulled off of the Sierra Club's website, where they state their opposition to this proposed mine. So I just want to kind of flag a few here to get the creative juices flowing. And so there's the first, right? So why be opposed to this mine? Well, the first is to note that this sort of immense tract of land that's being proposed as a location for this mine is a crucial habitat to wolves, bald eagles, songbirds, rare plants, and countless other animals. So there's one reason why you might worry about the mind. And so, you know, what's sort of striking me about this, and I'll flag this in the next slide too, is, you know, what's being singled out as the things we ought to care about, right? Which is a bunch of charismatic megafauna, right? Like wolves and bald eagles, but also songbirds and even the plants, right? They're all being singled out as things we ought to be concerned about. What but rare plants? Yesterday, after I put the slides together and I was sort of thinking about this, I thought, well, actually, it's sort of interesting that they focus only on rare. Surely it's not just rare plants, right? Surely it's plants generally that are threatened by this. And the fact that we care about rareness is interesting, too. But I won't say anything more about that. But I think it's interesting. Interesting to think about. Okay, so then the next was that it's critical for clean water resources and for wild rice production. And then the one that's most directly oriented to people, right? That it threatens local communities' air and water, endangering the health of the citizens in these cities. And so those are all direct quotes. The last bullet I put up here is a more general point. You know, they emphasize over and over again the sort of the massive scale of this mine, right, in acreage and in miles. And so I think it's fair to say that there's an emphasis also on the threat to the sort of the ecosystem writ large, right, of the area. And so anyway, those are some reasons why you might be concerned with the mine. Yeah, go ahead. So, all right, as I was sort of thinking about this, again, sort of someone who thinks about moral philosophy probably too much for my own good, I wanted to back up and just start with a distinction that's now going to sort of run through what I wanted to talk about today. And it's not a complicated distinction. It's just a distinction between intrinsic value on the one hand and instrumental or extrinsic value on the other hand, right? So, you know, for some easy examples of each, right? So, you know, people, right? I take it people kind of unconscious, so my kids, for example, right now, my daughters, Ava and Sophie are somewhere downstairs. And I take it, you know, uncontroversially, right? We take people like, you know, human children to be things with intrinsic value, right? That is just to say, you know, they matter in themselves, right? They have a kind of moral weight contained within themselves that is inherently valuable in a sense. And as a contrast, I think the classic example of something that's intrinsically valuable is, you know, money, right? Money. Right? So, you know, what's money, right? So if I pulled out like a $20 bill here, right, that has value because I can sort of do stuff with it, right? If I sort of hopped in a DeLorean and went back 500 years and I sort of pulled out my, you know, my $20 bill, it would have zero value. I could do nothing, maybe burn it or something, I'm not sure, right? But it would have virtually no value at all, right? And so, but you know, that's fine, right? Lots of things in our lives, I take it emphasizing the word things, are things that we have that we sort of place value on, but if we step back and think about this distinction, we'd recognize it's not that they matter in themselves, you know, like the pen I really like to write with, right? That's, you know, it's not gonna have any intrinsic value, it has instrumental value because I can write with it, because I like the feel of it in my hand, whatever. So there's a conceptual distinction that I want to put on the table because there's a sense in which now this is going to run throughout everything else I'm going to say now, right? Which is, as we think about respecting the interdependent web and we think about the things that make it up that you sort of see captured a little bit in some of those quotes in the Sierra Club about the taconite mine, I think it's really interesting to start to think about, well, what matters, right? Which of these things matter, how they matter, and how much they matter, right? How we sort of weigh these things against each other. And I guess that's what I wanted to think about a little bit. And so that's what I have sort of up here underneath the question, right? Which of the many things imperiled by the proposed mine have intrinsic value? And you can sort of think about, as you sort of think about that, I'm going to sort of pose some classical answers to this, some sort of radical classical answers to this question. But at least on the face of it, as you sort of reflect on it yourself, right, recognize there's lots of ways to answer that. I think one sort of answer is, well, you know, it all comes down to people. I think that's the narrowest answer, right? But you say, look, you know, why do we care about wolves or songbirds or water or whatever? Well, because there's a sense in which we like looking at them, because we need them to survive, whatever, right? So you could have an answer that basically says, all those things only matter with respect to us. But you know, I sort of hear the groans of displeasure with that, right? So as you imagine that circle is starting to widen as the things we matter, right? I think questions start to get more interesting, right? So what are the things that matter in themselves? And then I think equally important, you know, how much do they matter? And so you could think about the different elements of the web, and I guess especially because that principle talks about respecting the interdependent web by taking it in itself, right? That's an answer you could offer too, right? That the interdependent web itself, right? Or maybe more generally, the ecosystem itself is an object of intrinsic value, right? And so I want to start to explore some of these possibilities anyway in the next few minutes, next few slides. All right, go ahead. I want to sketch two radical views that have been offered in the 20th century by people you maybe or probably are familiar with. One of them being Albert Schweitzer, who the opening words are from. And the other being Aldo Leopold, right? Our own Aldo Leopold. I've been in Wisconsin 10 years now. I can make that claim. So what I want to do is sort of sketch the kinds of answers they give to this. I'll mention as an aside, I'll talk about this as we get into Schweitzer in a little bit more detail right now. The opening words were from Schweitzer, it's probably him who's most famous for endorsing this notion of the reverence for life. And I thought of this because if any of you were here for Sandy's talk several weeks ago on the Wild Women of the West or something ungoogleable, she said it, not me. That phrase, I think, was one that you found very, very appealing. So at any rate, let's go there now. So go ahead to the next slide, Kim. So there he is. There's Albert Schweitzer. There's his dates, born 1875, died 1965. Really kind of an interesting guy, sort of a polymath, right? So musician, a musicologist, theologian, Lutheran his whole life, a missionary, more sort of a medical missionary, he's a physician, also a philosopher. The story we heard today was a Nobel Peace Prize winner, and he in fact also was a Nobel Pre-Peace Prize winner. All right, yeah, so go to the next slide. Interesting connection. I had no idea about this. I'm sort of, you know, new to this whole Unitarian Universalist thing, so maybe you can forgive me for not knowing this. He's an honorary Unitarian. Who knew this, right? As it turns out, right? So here's the note that he was invited to be an honorary Unitarian back in 1961, and so here's his response that was published in the Bulletin of the Church of the Larger Fellowship. I'm just digging this stuff up. I don't have any expertise in this, right? But there it is. I thank you for your offer. I accept with pleasure. And so he had some affinity for connection with Unitarian Universalism. So anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. Go ahead. So here's what he's sort of famous for, right? This theme captured in that brief passage from the opening words, this notion of reverence for life, right? That's in fact what he won the Nobel Peace Prize for, connected with his activities around how he understood this. This is a quote from his book Civilization and Ethics, which was published in 1923. Ethics thus consists in this: that I experience the necessity of practicing the same reverence for life toward all will to live as toward my own. Therein, I have already the needed fundamental principle of morality. It is good to maintain and cherish life. It is evil to destroy and to check life. And so, you know, as you sort of think about this question of what things have inherent value, Schweitzer offers a pretty broad and powerful claim, right? That it's all living things. Anything that's alive, right, is sort of a locus of inherent value. I see some nods. There's something really appealing about that, I think. Of course, though, there's a big question. What does this mean in practice? And so, especially if you like this view, go to the next slide. I've got another quote from Schweitzer. Here it is. So if you were really to take on this view that all things have inherent value, Schweitzer thinks, at least this is what he says, here's what this would mean. Forgive the sexist language, it is, you know, a long time ago. A man is really ethical only when he goes out of his way to avoid injuring anything living. He does not ask how far this or that life deserves sympathy as valuable in itself, nor how far it is capable of feeling. To him, life as such is sacred. He shatters no ice crystal that sparkles in the sun, tears no leaf from its tree, breaks off no flower, and is careful not to crush any insect as he walks. If he works by lamplight on a summer evening, he prefers to keep the window shut and to breathe stifling air rather than to see insect after insect fall on his table with singed and sinking wings. If he goes out into the street after a rainstorm and sees a worm which has strayed there, he helps it back from the deadly paving stones into the lush grass. And actually, I'm cheating here a little bit. He's talking in the second quote. I mean, if you're sort of up on your dates, right? So he's writing in 1923. When's, you know, penicillin's what, 1928 or 29? So I'm cheating with antibiotics. But he does talk, he's a physician, and he's sort of recognizing our interaction with the microbial world, at least in a kind of provisional way. And he talks about the destruction of bacteria, right, as wholesale murder. Why? Well, they're living. They're living, right? And as something that's alive, it's something that fundamentally has value, right? And that fundamental value, right, impacts our actions, impacts our decisions, impacts what we have to do. So look, you know, I guess what I want to say is, if you really take on board this notion of reverence for life, and it's one view that you could hold about what kinds of things matter, recognize it could be pretty radical in how you think about what you do and how you live. One more slide. I threw this one in at the last minute. I don't know a heck of a lot about this, but it struck me that there's an interesting connection here. Probably many of you can say more about this than I can. Jainism is a religion primarily in Southeast Asia. I think we're talking about like something like 4 million people. But it's a religion where, I grabbed this picture because you can see sort of the mouth coverings, and you can also see the sweepers or the brooms that at least many traditional Jains sort of sweep the ground as they walk, right, so that they don't step on any bugs, right? And similarly, it's actually, I read a couple of different accounts when I was digging this up. I think the standard way of thinking about the mouth coverings is so they don't accidentally inhale any insects, right? I see some nods. I saw someone else say that it also is connected with the idea that words can do violence too, and it's a reminder of that. At any rate, though, right, this jumped out at me as a community of believers who, as much as any I could think of, sort of really take seriously this notion of life as having inherent value. And so maybe that's what we all should be doing if we think that. I'm not sure. At any rate, so there's one sort of radical view. Yeah, go ahead to the next slide. There we go, Aldo Leopold. Someone who's probably familiar to most of us. So there's again his dates, sort of a famous conservationist and ecologist and forester. There's a little bit about his connection with UW-Madison, where he was hired as professor of wildlife management. At any rate, so go ahead, Kim. His view, sometimes called ecocentrism, is laid out in the last section of his book, A Sand County Almanac. Which maybe some of you have read. It's sort of a famous book in the environmental movement. What's so interesting about it, and there's a quote, is the way that Leopold's endorsing a shift away from thinking of individual sort of discrete beings or things as having sort of value, and trying to redirect our attention to sort of the whole, right? The whole system, the ecosystem itself. And so it's in that last chapter of A Sand County Almanac that he offers one famous passage that encapsulates what he calls his land ethic, right? This idea, here it is, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. All right, so now, you know, so you can sort of see the shift, right? The shift is to the entire community, right? That actions are right when they advance the integrity, stability, and beauty of this thing, wrong when they detract from it. And, you know, for Leopold in particular, I mentioned up here, he's so concerned with this because he thinks so much of the damage we do to the environment comes from the way in which we see it as only having economic value, right? As a kind of instrumental value. And so this is the picture he paints. Again, what does it mean in practice? Yeah, go ahead. Let's say you're drawn to this, and you might be. Here's a couple of critics of the view that I think raise some powerful concerns about it, right? So William Aiken, who's an environmental writer, says, From the point of view of the land ethic, massive human diebacks would be good. It is our duty to cause them. It is our species' duty relative to the whole to eliminate 90% of our numbers. All right, so I sometimes think here, you know, if you've seen the movie The Matrix, right, the bad guy at the end says, you humans are a virus, right? I can't do the voice well, right? But it's just the idea, I mean, I take it, right, it's probably not that controversial to say, if you think about the massive damage inflicted on the world, you know, it's by us. It's by there being so many of us doing the sorts of things we do. And that if you really wanted to take the locus of intrinsic value and sort of center it on the system itself, well, what are the things that are bad for the system? You know, like us, kind of straightforwardly. And so that's why here's another quote. Tom Regan, who's particularly sort of famous in the environment animal rights movement. He's got a book from a couple of decades ago, The Case for Animal Rights, that I think has sold a lot of copies and is pretty well known. At any rate, you know, he calls the view, and I think take the word seriously, right, environmental fascism. Right, a kind of, if you think of fascism politically as a kind of prioritization of the whole at the expense of the individual, it's at least a part of the reason we find it typically pretty repugnant, right? That is, we find it, we're sort of opposed to fascism politically, and Regan thinks for the same reason we ought to be opposed to this sort of view from Leopold, right? That prioritizing of the whole obscures too much the individual. Maybe so, right? J. Baird Callicott is actually a defender of this sort of view, but even he recognizes, I sort of like this quote, that the land ethic is holistic with a vengeance, right? Holistic with a vengeance, right? If you really take it seriously, it kind of forces you to ask some very hard questions. Go to the next slide. So there were a couple of views, relatively famous, offered by, you know, relatively famous people. And then I guess I thought it'd be useful to kind of come back to that case, the test case of the taconite mine, and just to start to think through, right, that question or set of questions, right? If you're opposed to it, right, on what grounds, right? It's like, I take it is a kind of, whatever else it is, a kind of moral opposition to this, right? That morally speaking, we do something wrong when we sort of engage in this mining practice. And so now, I think, if that's a position, not ever, maybe you don't, but if that's a position you endorse, right, the next question you ought to ask is, okay, why, right? What are sort of the moral features that are relevant to this judgment that you're making? And I think there's lots of answers you could give, right? You know, and so I kind of tossed them out before, you know, in the shadow of at least briefly sketching these two famous views. I think it's worth putting them on the table again, right? Because there's answers you could give, right? One is you might be opposed to it because it's bad for people, right? It's bad for us, right? It does bad things to our water. It does bad things to the beautiful things we like to see. Whatever, right? You could focus your answer there. But you could also move out, right? Out to the charismatic megafauna, right? You could move outward to sentient creatures generally, right? Even the ones that we don't necessarily, you know. By charismatic megafauna, by the way, I just mean the kind of, it's not my own term, right? But it's the sorts of creatures that, you know, tend to be on the front of the pamphlets that the environmental organizations give out, right? So think your glorious birds or your, you know, beautiful predators or whatever. But it's not just them, right? You might also move away from those to the sentient creatures generally that occupy the lands or are affected by the behavior. You might move outward further and think about living things, such as not just the rare plants, the plants generally. You might think about the system itself, right, and ask that question, which of these things have intrinsic value, which have only an instrumental value? And I put this second question on here, well, because, you know, my suspicion is probably for a lot of you right now, you're thinking, well, you know, a lot of them have intrinsic value, that's sort of where I am too on this, right? I'm sort of inclined to think that that's right as well. But then the interesting question becomes, I mean, that's a really interesting, complicated position to land on, because, you know, if I'm saying there's a plurality of things that have intrinsic value, how do I weigh them against each other, right? I mean, I take it, you know, for someone like Schweitzer, right, the answer to that is a kind of egalitarian view. That fundamentally, right, the living things, to the extent that they're alive, matter no more or no less than any other living thing. And that's one way to answer the question. But if you want to stake out a view that's inegalitarian, right, that gets, so in other words, you want to say something like, well, yeah, the plants matter, but maybe not as much as the people. The system matters itself, but yet again, the people matter more. Okay, again, you've got some work to do to kind of justify that, right? Because whenever we start to, and maybe in some ways this is connecting with my, the if some of you are here, the talk I gave back in January, whenever we start to carve up the moral universe and start to say some things matter more than other things, and I think that's what, I mean, I think we do that, and I think there's good reason to do that, but we have to be really careful when we do it, right? Because it's very easy to say that some things count more, mostly because it's easy or it feels good, but we don't have good justification for it. I think it's Leopold, and I don't want to sort of give away too much, but it's because this is connected with the closing words, but Leopold kind of starts his land ethic by emphasizing views that we've had in the past connected with slavery or the oppression of women or whatever that is. It's very easy to step back and say, well, sure, you know, women count, but not as much as the men, right? I mean, you could say that, right? And probably there's lots of people who have held and still hold a view like that. But we don't think that's a defensible view, right? That is, I think the right response is, if you're going to make that distinction, right, you owe it to all of us to offer some justification for that distinction. And if you can't give one, then you ought to give that distinction up. And I think as a general point, this is at least Leopold's point when he raises it, the same ought to apply to how we think about the natural world generally. If we're going to, and I think we typically do, make distinctions, right, we want to endorse the idea that a variety of kinds of things matter, but some matter more than others, right? You're sort of more or less forced, I think, by a matter of, I don't know, consistency to sort of say, here's why. I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying I think that's in some ways the next logical step. One more slide, Kim, if you don't mind. So again, sort of bringing this now full circle, because I've been talking for a half hour, so I want to stop now, to this interdependent web that we do respect, we ought to expect, we're charged with expecting, if we're sitting here, I'm not sure, right? But, you know, this interdependent web of which we're all a part, right? I'm on board with this. Like I said, nothing here, I hope, was meant to challenge the principle so much as to think through what it means. Okay, I like that, I agree. I take it most of you do too. So then, okay, what is it about that web that matters, right? Again, is it the web itself? Is it the things that make it up? As we think about the various kinds of elements of that web, including the web itself, how do we assign value to them, right? If we want to stake out the claim that some of those things matter more than others, on what grounds are we staking that out, right? What's allowing us to privilege certain sorts of things over others? I think that's, I mean, to me, you know, I guess I'll sort of back up and just make a kind of an autobiographical moral point. To me, this is one of the most important things we can do with our moral principles generally, right? Is to step back and think through what they mean and the grounds on which we hold them. I think in some ways that's a moral duty all by itself. Anyway, I think that's the last slide. So that's it. Yeah, thanks. So a few things to say about that. So the first is, I mean, even at that level, recognize it's not that nothing has intrinsic value, it's that only people do, right? And so everything else only has value insofar as it's useful to or meaningful to people. I'll say a couple. Pardon? I think fair enough, right? So which people, right, and which people get a voice is a really important question there too. You know, there's a recent book out that's gotten a lot of attention by Piketty. Piketty, right? Capital in the 20th century, 21st century? Yeah. Where he's an economist who's basically arguing that there's really been some fundamentally mistaken assumptions that economists have been making about the power and the sort of self-correcting mechanisms built into capitalism that I think are very sympathetic to what you're saying. I think you're right about that. I think in that respect, Leopold was exactly right, right? That if you reduce everything to purely economic terms, you're left with a really barren and moral picture, and also, I think, in the long run, a really bleak picture for all of us. Now, that said, even I'm being cheap here when I say all of us, because the other thing that contemporary economics struggles with is how to give value to future persons, right? So there's like a diminishing value of future persons, where once you get out a few generations, they basically don't matter at all into any standard economic calculation. And I think that's probably problematic too. So in all kinds of ways, I think the assumptions that are built into exactly what you're critical with are just bad assumptions. Yeah. Yeah, look, I think that's one of the tricky questions to take up, because it treads on some pretty sensitive terrain, right? I mean, what's the population of humans over the last how many thousands of years? It sort of goes whoop, right, shoots right up, right, in the last century or so, or even half century. And so, yeah, sure. I mean, I think about this a lot, because on the one hand, I'm really drawn to the idea that we, seriously ought to think about, for example, sustainable agricultural practices. On the other hand, right, there's only so much sustainability you can build into a system that's trying to feed billions and billions and billions of people, and more of them by the year. So then what does that mean, right? From a as a moral question, it seems to me it starts to tilt towards some moral positions that are hard to hold, right? Like, we ought not to, reproduce in certain large numbers, right? So maybe we ought to think that people have a moral requirement to limit the number of offspring they have. The question you're bringing up is related to that. Maybe we have a moral requirement to die? Yeah, right? I don't mean to be endorsing any of these things, right? But in some ways, they follow somewhat naturally from the worries you're bringing up, right? I mean, the world's only so big, right? Yeah, I think anytime you're talking about a situation of finite resources, you could talk about being more efficient with those resources. Certainly we're profligate in our inefficiency, right? And so there's probably a lot to be said about being more efficient, but there's a ceiling on how much you can do by making gains in efficiency. I think that's an awesome question, because it really presses on the question about value that I've been trying to raise, right? That is, right, if we do think, right, that it's fundamentally persons that have moral value, then absolutely, right? Then presumably there is an amount of good we could do for persons that would just swamp whatever instrumental value these things have, right, in the calculations, right? Whereas if you think that the creatures being affected have intrinsic value, or the system has intrinsic value, then one implication of that is that you can't trade that off for gains for other things, right? And so if we think that it's only humans that have the value, then sure, if the mine had like super awesome valuable stuff mine instead of the low-grade taconite mine, right, then at that point the calculation would just tilt, right? Because these things don't matter in themselves. They only matter with respect to us. But if the creatures or the land or whatever have intrinsic value, then that's what blocks the trade-off. That's where it says, no matter how much good you can do for people, it's not the sort of thing you can use in that way. I mean, certainly, if he thought that you could poke holes in all the economic and aesthetic arguments, for example, recognize an argument that appeals to the value of these things in economic or aesthetic terms is appealing to the instrumental value of these things, right? So either they're valuable for us in economic terms, or we appreciate looking at them and enjoy their beauty or whatever, but they have no value in themselves. If you believe that these objects have value in themselves, well, now you've got a hard sort of meta-ethical question, right? What is it that gives them this value? And that's where certain kinds of religious views might help, right? So if you believe, for example, in a deity that like endowed these things with a certain unassailable value, then you've got a straight line story for why you should think they have intrinsic value. And if you deny the existence of such a deity, right, now you've got a harder story to tell about how we think about intrinsic value generally. Where does it come from? What gives things value? And boy, that's a hard question, right? It's a big question. And so I think at least that's to my mind, when you ask my reaction to your description of that book, you know, that's it. I mean, I think he's on to something there for sure, which is the quickest way to get something intrinsic value is to find, you know, somebody of the ultimate authority who assigned it that, right? And that's what a religious view could sometimes get you, for sure. Yeah. So I mean, two things about that. One is, you know, yeah, it's what you just said is so deeply sympathetic with the story that Schweitzer's telling, right? That you know, Schweitzer, and he's great to read because he just bleeds onto the page. You can feel what he believes, and it's very much the same, right? He's wrestling with this in such a deep way. You know, how can I ever walk across a field knowing that I'm damaging the grass? How could I ever, you know? And so you're very much in line with him. I mean, the idea that rocks and other natural objects are capable of cognitive states, like having memories, for example. It's a big one, because there's a big question around how we understand other minds generally. I know we're sort of short on time, and so I could say a lot about this. Recognize we're always at the only being's cognitive state that I have certainty about is my own. Right? As soon as I move outside of myself, even just the people in this room, right, I'm at a distance now from you. And so, you know, I understand how you think and feel with a high degree of probability, I think, because of the evidence I have, right? So you look up to me and kick me, I'll hop around, ow, that hurt a lot. I'll look up to you and kick you, you behave the same, right? Maybe, you know, we hook each other up to brain scans and we see similar kinds of brain activity when we're kicked. And these are the reasons why I infer that the pain you feel when you get kicked is the same pain that I feel when I get kicked. Okay, now about what kinds of things do we have similar kinds of confidence, right? Well, I don't know, the mammalian kingdom generally, right? So there's this, when we talk about other mammals, that's not kingdom, right? But anyway, kingdom, phylum, class, I forget. Yeah, biology in 10th grade. But when we move out to other mammals, similarly, right, I kick a dog, it doesn't say ow, but it, or whatever it does, right? And the brain scan will be similar in some ways too. Now what about when I move to, I don't know, shellfish? Trickier, right? Now, what about when I move to, like, plants? You know, here's what I know, right? I have a plant in my house. If I don't water it, or if I stick in the closet for 2 weeks, it shows signs of stress, of what? Is it only metaphorical to say the plant wants water or something? I mean, I'm inclined to think so, but there's just potentially a lot to say about that. It's a really good question. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, anyway, I'll stop now. Thanks. Yeah.
Well, let's try Aldo Leopold here. This might not quite rate, but you know, there's a lot of work to do, and we can do it, so here we go. There is as yet no ethic dealing with man's people's relations to land and to the animals and plants which grow up on it. Land, like Odysseus's slave girls, is still property. The land relation is still strictly economic, entailing privileges but not obligations. Go in peace and join an environmental group.